is over. He turned away. Taking Valentina's arm, he moved toward the west door. The mother and brother followed. There was no point in going after them, Barney knew. It would only make Carlos look foolish. Carlos was hurt and angry, Barney could see. The accusation of impure blood was silly, but probably no less wounding for that. In this country, impure usually meant Jewish or Muslim, and Barney had not heard it used of someone with English forebears. But people could be snobbish about anything. Ebrima and Betsy joined them. Betsy noticed Carlos's mood immediately, and looked inquiringly at Barney. He murmured, "Valentina's father rejected him." "Hell," said Betsy. She was angered, but did not seem surprised, and the thought crossed Barney's mind that somehow she had expected this. Ibrima felt sorry for Carlos, and wanted to do something to cheer him up. When they got home, he suggested trying out the new furnace. This was as good a time as any, he thought, and it might take Carlos's mind off his humiliation. It was forbidden for Christians to work or do business on a Sunday, of course, but this was not really work. It was an experiment. Carlos liked the idea. He fired up the furnace while Ibrima put the ox into the harness they had devised, and Barney mixed crushed iron ore with lime. There was a snag with the bellows, and they had to redesign the mechanism driven by the ox. Betsy abandoned her plans for an elegant Sunday dinner, and brought out bread and salt pork, which the three men ate standing up. The afternoon light was fading by the time they had everything working again. When the fire was burning hot, fanned by the twin bellows, Ibrima started shoveling in the iron ore and lime. For a while, nothing seemed to be happening. The ox walked in a patient circle, the bellows puffed and panted, the chimney radiated heat, and the men waited. Carlos had heard about this way of making iron from two people, a Frenchman from Normandy and a Walloon from the Netherlands. And Barney had heard something similar talked of by an Englishman from Sussex. They all claimed the method produced iron twice as fast. That might have been an exaggeration, but even so, it was an exciting idea. They said that molten iron would emerge from the bottom of the furnace, and Carlos had duly built a stone chute to carry the flow to ingot-shaped depressions in the earth of the courtyard. But no one had been able to draw a plan of the furnace, so the design was guesswork. Still, no iron emerged. Ibrima began to wonder what might have gone wrong. Maybe the chimney should have been taller. Heat was the key, he thought. Perhaps they should have used wood charcoal, which burned hotter than coal, though it was expensive in a country where all the trees were needed to build the king's ships. Then it began to work. A half-moon of molten iron appeared at the outlet of the furnace and inched into the stone chute. A hesitant protuberance became a slow wave, then a gush. The men cheered. Elisa came to look. The liquid metal was red at first, but quickly turned grey. Looking hard at it, Ibrima thought it was more like pig iron, and would need to be smelted again to refine it, but that was not a major problem. On top of the iron was a layer like molten glass, which was undoubtedly slag, and they would have to find a way to skim that off the top. But the process was fast. Once it got started, the iron came out as if a tap had been turned. All they had to do was keep putting coal, iron ore, and lime into the top of the furnace, and liquid wealth would pour out the other end. The three men congratulated one another. Elisa brought them a bottle of wine. They stood with cups in their hands, drinking and staring in delight at the iron as it hardened. Carlos looked more cheerful. He was recovering from the shock of his rejection. Perhaps Carlos would choose this celebratory moment to tell Ibrima that he was a free man. After a few minutes, Carlos said, "Stoke the furnace, Ibrima." Ibrima put down his cup. "Right away," he said. The new furnace was a triumph for Carlos, but not everyone was happy about that. The furnace worked from sunrise to sunset, 6 days a week. Carlos sold the pig iron to a finery forge, so that he did not have to refine it himself, and could concentrate on production, while Barney secured the increased supplies of iron ore they needed. The king's armourer was pleased. He struggled constantly to buy enough weapons for warfare in France and Italy, for sea battles with the Sultan's fleet, and for protection against pirates, for galleons from America. The forges and workshops of Seville could not produce enough, and the corporations opposed any expansion of capacity, so the armourer had to buy much of what he needed from foreign countries, which was why the American silver that came into Spain went out again so quickly. He was thrilled to see iron being produced so fast. But other iron makers in Seville were not so glad. They could see that Carlos was making twice as much money as they were. Surely there was a rule against this. Sancho Sanchez lodged an official complaint with the corporation. The council would have to make a decision. Barney was worried, but Carlos said the corporation could not possibly go against the king's armourer. Then they were visited by Father Alonso. They were working in the courtyard when Alonso marched in, followed by a small entourage of younger priests. Carlos leaned on his shovel and stared at the Inquisitor, trying to look unworried, but failing, Barney thought. Aunt Betsy came out of the house and stood with her big hands on her broad hips, ready to take Alonso on. Barney could not imagine how Carlos could be accused of being a heretic. On the other hand, why else would Alonso be here? Before saying anything, Alonso looked slowly around the courtyard with his narrow, beaked nose in the air, like a bird of prey. His gaze rested on Ibrima, and at last he spoke. "Is that black man a Muslim?" Ibrima answered for himself. "In the village where I was born, father, the gospel of Jesus Christ had never been heard, nor had the name of the Muslim prophet ever been spoken. I was raised in heathen ignorance, like my forefathers. But throughout a long journey, God's hand guided me, and when I was taught the sacred truth here in Seville, I became a Christian, baptized in the cathedral, for which I thank my Heavenly Father every day in my prayers." It was such a good speech that Barney guessed Ibrima must have made it before. But it was not enough for Alonso. He said, "Then why do you work on Sundays? Is it not because your Muslim holy day is Friday?" Carlos said, "No one here works on Sundays, and we all work all day, every Friday. Your furnace was seen to be lit on the Sunday I preached my first sermon in the cathedral." Barney cursed under his breath. They had been caught out. He surveyed the surrounding buildings. The courtyard was overlooked by numerous windows. One of the neighbors had made the accusation, probably a jealous metal worker, perhaps even Sancho. "But we weren't working," said Carlos. "We were conducting an experiment." It sounded thin, even to Barney. Carlos went on with a note of desperation. "You see, father, this type of furnace has air blown in at the bottom of the chimney."
"I know all about your furnace,"
Alonso interrupted. Aunt Betsy spoke up.
"I wonder how a priest would know all about a furnace. Perhaps you've been talking to my grandson's rivals. Who denounced him to you, father?"
Barney could see from Alonso's face that Aunt Betsy was right, but the priest did not answer the question. Instead, he went on the offensive.
"Old woman, you were born in Protestant England."
"I most certainly was not," Betsy said with spirit. "The good Catholic King Henry VII was on the throne of England when I was born. His Protestant son, Henry VIII, was still pissing in his bed when my family left England and brought me here to Seville. I've never been back."
Alonso turned on Barney, and Barney felt the deep chill of fear. This man had the power to torture and kill people.
"That's certainly not true of you," Alonso said. "You must have been born and raised Protestant."
Barney's Spanish was not good enough for a theological argument, so he kept his response simple. "England is no longer Protestant, nor am I. Father, if you search this house, you will see that there are no banned books here, no heretical texts, no Muslim prayer mats. Over my bed is a crucifix, and on my wall a picture of St. Hubert of Liege, patron saint of metalworkers. It was St. Hubert who..."
"I know about St. Hubert."
Clearly Alonso was offended by any suggestion that someone else might have something to teach him. However, Barney thought he might have run out of steam. Each of his accusations had been parried. All he had was men doing something that might or might not count as working on a Sunday, and Carlos and his family were surely not the only people in Seville who bent that rule.
I hope everything you have said to me today is the pure truth,
Alonso said. Otherwise you will suffer the fate of Pedro Ruiz. He turned to go, but Barney stopped him. What happened to Pedro Ruiz? Pedro was the father of Geronima. Alonso looked pleased to have shocked him.
He was arrested, he said. In his house, I found a translation of the Old Testament into Spanish, which is illegal, and a copy of the heretical Institutes of the Christian Religion by John Calvin, the Protestant leader of the abominable city of Geneva. As is normal, all the possessions of Pedro Ruiz have been sequestrated by the Inquisition.
Carlos did not seem surprised by this, so Alonso must have been telling the truth when he said it was normal, but Barney was shocked.
All his possessions, he said. How will his daughter live? By God's grace, as we all do, said Alonso,
and then he walked out, followed by his entourage. Carlos looked relieved.
I'm sorry about Geronimo's father, he said, but I think we got the better of Alonso.
Betsy said,
Don't be so sure.
Why do you say that? Carlos asked.
You don't remember your grandfather, my husband. He died when I was a baby.
Rest his soul. He was raised Muslim.
All three men stared at her in astonishment. Carlos said incredulously,
Your husband was a Muslim?
At first, yes.
My grandfather, Jose Alano Cruz?
His original name was Yusuf Al-Khalil.
How could you marry a Muslim?
When they were expelled from Spain, he decided to convert to Christianity rather than leave. He took instruction in the religion and was baptized as an adult, just like Ibrima. Jose was his new name. To seal his conversion, he decided to marry a Christian girl. That was me. I was 13.
Barney said, Did many Muslims marry Christians?
No. They married within their community, even after converting. My Jose was unusual.
Carlos was more interested in the personal side.
Did you know he had been raised Muslim?
Not at first. No. He had moved here from Madrid and told no one. But people come here from Madrid all the time, and eventually there was someone who had known him as a Muslim. After that, it was never quite secret, though we tried to keep it quiet.
Barney could not restrain his curiosity.
You were 13.
Did you love him?
I adored him. I was never a pretty girl, and he was handsome and charming. He was also affectionate and kind and caring. I was in heaven.
Aunt Betsy was in a confiding mood. Carlos said,
And then my grandfather died. I was inconsolable, said Betsy.
He was the love of my life. I never wanted another husband.
She shrugged.
But I had my children to take care of, so I was too busy to die of grief. And then there was you, Carlos, motherless before you were a day old.
Barney had an instinctive feeling that, although Betsy was speaking candidly, there was something she was holding back. She had not wanted another husband. But was that the whole story? Carlos made a connection.
Is this why Francisco Villaverde won't let me marry his daughter?
It is. He doesn't care about your English grandmother. It's your Muslim grandfather he considers impure.
Hell.
That's not the worst of your problems. Obviously, Alonso, too, knows about Yusuf Al-Khalil. Today's visit was just the beginning. Believe me, he will be back.
After Alonso's visit, Barney went to the home of the Ruiz family to see what had happened to Geronima. The door was opened by a young woman who looked North African and was evidently a slave. She was probably beautiful, he thought, but now her face was swollen and her eyes were red with grief.
I must see Geronima, he said in a loud voice.
The woman put her finger to her lips in a shushing gesture, then beckoned him to follow her and led him into the back of the house. He expected to see a cook and a couple of maids preparing dinner, but the kitchen was cold and silent. He recalled Alonso saying that the Inquisition routinely confiscated a suspect's goods, but Barney had not realized how fast it would happen. Now he saw that Pedro's employees had already been dismissed. Presumably, his slave was going to be sold, which would be why she was crying.
She said, I am Farah.
Barney said impatiently, Why have you brought me here?
Where is Hieronima?
Speak quietly.
She said, Hieronima is upstairs, with Archdeacon Romero.
I don't care. I want to speak to her, said Barney, and he stepped to the door.
Please don't,
said Farah.
It will cause trouble if Romero sees you.
I'm ready for trouble.
I'll bring Hieronima here. I see a nearby woman has called and insists on seeing her.
Barney hesitated, then nodded assent, and Farah went out. He looked around. There were no knives, pots, jugs, or plates. The place had been cleared out. Did the Inquisition even sell people's kitchenware? Hieronima appeared a couple of minutes later. She was different. She looked a lot older than 17, suddenly. Her beautiful face was an impassive mask, and her eyes were dry, but her olive skin seemed to have turned grey, and her slim body trembled all over as if shivering. He could see the enormous effort it took to bottle up her grief and rage. Barney moved toward her, intending to embrace her, but she stepped back and held up her hands as if to push him away. He looked at her helplessly and said,
What's going on? I am destitute,
she said. My father is in prison, and I have no other family.
How is he?
I don't know.
Prisoners of the Inquisition are not allowed to communicate with their families, or with anyone else. But his health is poor. You've heard him panting after even a short walk, and they will probably...
She became unable to speak, but it lasted only a moment. She looked down, breathed in, and regained control.
They will probably put him to the water torture.
Barney had heard of this. The victim's nostrils were closed to prevent him breathing through his nose, and his mouth was forced open. Then jar after jar of water was poured down his throat. What he swallowed distended his stomach agonizingly, and the water that got into his windpipe choked him.
It will kill him,
Barney said in horror.
They have already taken all his money and possessions. What are you going to do? Archdeacon Romero has offered to take me into his household.
Barney felt bewildered. Things were moving too fast. Several questions occurred to him at the same time. He said,
In what role? We are discussing that right now. He wants me to take charge of his wardrobe, ordering and caring for his vestments, supervising his laundress.
Speaking of such practical matters clearly helped her control her feelings.
Don't go, Barney said. Come away with me.
It was a reckless offer, and she knew it.
Where? I can't live with three men. It's all right for your grandmother. I have a home in England.
She shook her head.
I know nothing about your family. I hardly know anything about you. I don't speak English.
Her face softened briefly.
Perhaps, if this had not happened, you might have courted me and made a formal offer to my father, and perhaps I would have married you and learned to speak English. Who knows? I admit I have thought about it. But to run away with you to a strange country? No.
Barney could see that she was being much more sensible than he. But all the same, he blurted, Romero wants to make you his secret mistress.
Hieronima looked at Barney, and he saw in her big eyes a hardness he had never noticed before. He was reminded of Aunt Betsy's words. Hieronima Ruiz has her eye firmly on her own selfish interests.
But surely there were limits.
Hieronima now said, And if he does?
Barney was dumbfounded.
How can you even say it? I've been thinking about this for 48 sleepless hours. I have no alternative. You know what happens to homeless women. They become prostitutes.
This seemed not to shake her.
So my choice is flight with you into the unknown, prostitution on the streets, or a dubious position in the affluent household of a corrupt priest. Has it occurred to you,
Barney said tentatively, that Romero might even have denounced your father himself, with the intention of forcing you into this position?
I'm sure he did.
Barney was astonished again. She was always ahead of him. She said,
I've known for months that Romero wanted to make me his mistress. It was the worst life I could imagine for myself. Now, It's the best life I can hope for. And he has done that to you. I know. And you're going to accept it and go to his bed and forgive him?
Forgive him? She said, and a new light came into her brown eyes, a look of hatred, like boiling acid.
No, she said, I might pretend, but one day I will have power over him, and when that day comes, I will take revenge.
Ebrimer had done as much as anyone to make the new furnace work, and he harbored a secret hope that Carlos would reward him by giving him his freedom. But as the furnace burned for days and weeks, his hopes faded, and he realized that the thought had not even crossed Carlos's mind. Loading cold ingots of iron onto a flatbed cart, stacking them in an interlocking web so that they would not shift in transit, Ebrimer considered what to do next. He had hoped Carlos would make the offer spontaneously, but as that had not happened, he would have to ask outright. He did not like to beg. The very act of pleading would suggest he was not entitled to what he wanted, but he was entitled. He felt that strongly. He might try to recruit Elisa to support him. She was fond of him and wanted the best for him, he felt sure. But did her affection extend so far as to free him, in which case he would no longer be there when she needed love at night? On balance, it would probably be best to take her into his confidence before he spoke to Carlos. At least then he would know which way she was going to jump when the decision was made. When should he tell her? After making love one night? It might be smarter to raise the subject before lovemaking, when her heart was full of desire. He nodded to himself, and at that moment the attack began. There were 6 men, and they all carried clubs and hammers. They did not speak, but immediately began to beat Ebrimer and Carlos with the clubs. "What's happening?" Ebrimer yelled. "Why are you doing this?" They did not speak. Ebrimer put up an arm to protect himself and suffered an agonizing blow to his hand, then another to his head, and he fell down. His assailant then went after Carlos, who was retreating across the yard. Ebrimer watched, trying to recover from the daze induced by the blow to his head. Carlos seized a shovel, dipped it in the molten metal coming out of the furnace, and threw a shower of droplets at the attackers. 2 of them screamed in pain. For a moment, Ebrimer thought perhaps he and Carlos might prevail, despite the odds. But before Carlos could scoop up more metal, 2 others got to him and knocked him down. They then attacked the new furnace, smashing its brickwork with iron-headed sledgehammers. Ebrimer saw his creation being destroyed, and found the strength to get to his feet. He rushed at the attackers, screaming, "No, you can't do this!" He shoved one so that he fell to the ground and pulled the other away from the precious furnace. He used only his right hand, because he could no longer grip with the left, but he was strong. Then he was forced to scurry backward out of the way of a lethally swinging sledgehammer. Desperate to save the furnace, he picked up a wooden shovel and went at them again. He hit one over the head. Then he was hit from behind, a blow that landed on his right shoulder and caused him to drop the shovel. He turned to face his assailant and dodged the next blow. As he backed away, desperately leaping out of the way of a down-swinging club, he could see from the corner of his eye that the furnace was being demolished. The contents poured out, burning coal and red-hot minerals spilling over the ground. The ox began to grunt raucously in panic, a pitiful noise. Elisa came running out of the house, screaming at the men. "Leave them alone! Get out of here!" The attackers laughed at the old woman, and one of the men Ebrimer had knocked down got up, seized her from behind and lifted her off her feet. He was big, they all were, and he easily restrained her writhing struggles. 2 men were sitting on Carlos. One was holding Elisa, and one was keeping Ebrimer cornered. The remaining 2 went to work with their sledgehammers. They smashed the bellows mechanism that Ebrimer and Carlos and Barney had puzzled over so long. Ebrimer could have wept. When the furnace and the bellows mechanism were flattened, one of them pulled a long dagger and tried to cut the throat of the ox. It was not easy. The beast's neck was thickly muscled, and he had to saw through the flesh with his knife, while the ox tried to kick free of the wreckage. At last, he severed the jugular. The bellowing stopped abruptly. Blood came like a fountain from the wound. The ox sank to the ground. And then, as quickly as they had come, The six men left. Hieronima had become a calculating shrew, Barney thought, as he left the Ruiz house in a daze. Perhaps she had always had a hard streak, and he had never noticed it. Or perhaps people could be transformed by a terrible ordeal. He did not know. He felt he knew nothing. Anything could happen. The river might rise up and drown the city. His feet took him automatically to Carlos's house, and there he suffered another shock. Carlos and Ibrima had been beaten up. Carlos was sitting on a chair in the courtyard, while Aunt Betsy tended to his wounds. One eye was closed, his lips were swollen and bloody, and he sat half bent over as if his belly hurt. Ibrima lay on the ground, clutching one hand under the opposite armpit, a blood-stained bandage around his head. Behind them was the wreckage of the new furnace. It had been ruined, and was now a pile of bricks. The bellows mechanism was a tangle of ropes and firewood. The ox lay dead in a pool of blood. There was a lot of blood in an ox, Barney thought, disjointedly. Betsy had been bathing Carlos's face with a scrap of linen soaked in wine. Now she stood upright and tossed the rag on the ground in a gesture of disgust. "Listen to me," she said, and Barney realized she had been waiting only for his return before making a speech. All the same, he forestalled her. "What happened here? Don't ask stupid questions," she said impatiently. "You can see what happened here. I mean, who did this? They were men we've never seen before, and almost certainly they're not from Seville. The real question is who hired them, and the answer is Sancho Sanchez. He's the one who's been whipping up resentment of Carlos's success, and he's the one who wants to buy the business. I've no doubt it was he who told Alonso that Ibrima is a Muslim and works on Sundays. What are we going to do?" Carlos answered Barney's question. Standing up, he said, "We're going to give in." "What do you mean?" "We could fight, Sancho, or we could fight Alonso, but we can't fight both." He went over to where Ibrima lay, grasped his right hand, the left was evidently injured, and pulled him to his feet. "I'm going to sell the business." Betsy said, "That may not be enough now." Carlos was startled. "Why?" "Sancho will be satisfied with the business, but Alonso will not. He needs a human sacrifice. He can't admit to having made a mistake. Now that he's accused you, he has to punish you." Barney said, "I've just seen Hieronima. She thinks they will put her father to the water torture. We'll all confess to heresy if that happens to us." Betsy said, "Barney is right." Carlos said, "What can we do?" Betsy sighed. "Leave Seville. Leave Spain. Today." Barney was shocked, but he knew she was right. Alonso's men might come for them any time, and when that happened, it would be too late to flee. He looked apprehensively at the archway entrance to the courtyard, fearing that they might already be there. But there was no one, not yet. Was it even possible to go today? Perhaps, if there was a ship leaving on the afternoon tide, and if that ship needed crew, they would probably have no choice about where they went. Barney glanced up at the sun. It was after midday. "If we're really going to do this, we need to hurry," he said. Despite the danger he was in, his spirits lifted at the prospect of going to sea. Ibrima spoke for the first time. "If we don't go, we're dead men," he said, "and I'll be the first." Barney said, "What about you, Aunt Betsy?" "I'm too old to go far. Besides, they don't really care about me. I'm a woman." "What will you do?" "I have a sister-in-law in Carmona." Barney recalled Betsy going there for a few weeks in the summer. "I can walk to Carmona in a morning. Even if Alonso finds out where I am, I doubt that he'll bother with me." Carlos made up his mind. "Barney, Ibrima, get whatever you want from the house, and be back by a count of 100. None of them had many possessions. Barney tucked a small purse of money into his waist under his shirt. He put on his best boots and his heavy cloak. He did not own a sword. The heavy longsword was made for the battlefield, designed to be thrust into the vulnerable spots in the enemy's suit of armor, but unwieldy at close quarters. Barney sheathed a 2-foot-long Spanish dagger with a disc-shaped hilt and a double-edged steel blade. In a street brawl, a big knife such as this was more lethal than a sword. Back in the courtyard, Carlos was wearing a sword under his new coat with the fur collar. He hugged his grandmother, who was weeping. Barney kissed her on the cheek. Then Aunt Betsy said to Ebrima,
"Kiss me one more time, my love."
Ebrima took her in his arms. Barney frowned, and Carlos said,
"Hey!"
Aunt Betsy kissed Ebrima passionately, her hand buried in his dark hair, while Carlos and Barney stared in astonishment. When they broke the kiss, she said,
"I love you, Ebrima. I don't want you to go. But I can't let you stay here to die in the torture chamber of the Inquisition."
"Thank you, Elisa, for being kind to me," said Ebrima.
They kissed again, then Betsy turned away and ran into the house. Barney thought,
"What the hell?"
Carlos looked amazed, but there was no time for questions.
"Let's go,"
he said. "One second," said Barney. He showed them his dagger. "If we meet Alonso's men on the way, I won't be taken alive."
"Nor will I,"
said Carlos, touching the hilt of his sword. Ebrima pulled aside his cloak to reveal an iron-headed hammer thrust into his belt. The three men left, heading for the waterfront. They were alert for Alonso's men, but as they moved farther from the house, the danger receded. All the same, people stared at them, and Barney realized that they looked scary, with both Carlos and Ebrima bruised and still bleeding from the fight. After a few minutes, Carlos said to Ebrima,
"Grandma?" Ebrima spoke calmly. "Slaves are always used for sex. You must know that."
Barney said,
"I didn't know it.
We talk to one another in the marketplace. Just about every one of us is somebody's whore. Not the old ones, but slaves don't often live to be old."
He looked at Barney.
"Pedro Ruiz, your girlfriend's father, fucks Farah, though she has to get on top."
"Is that why she was crying? Because she's lost him?"
"She was crying because now she will be sold, and a stranger will fuck her."
Ebrima turned to Carlos.
"Francisco Villaverde, who is too proud to be your father-in-law, always buys slaves as small boys, and buggers them until they grow up. Then he sells them to a farmer."
Carlos was still incredulous.
"So every night, when I'm asleep, you've been going to Grandma's bedroom?" "Not every night. Just when she asked me."
Barney said, "Did you mind?"
"Elisa is an old woman, but she's warm and loving. And I was glad it wasn't a man."
Barney felt as if he had been a child until today. He had known that priests could put a man in prison and torture him to death, but not that they could also take all his possessions and make his family destitute. He had not imagined that an archdeacon would take a girl into his house and make her his mistress, and he had no idea what men and women did with their slaves. It was as if he had been living in a house with rooms he had never entered, sharing it with strange people he had never previously set eyes on. He was disoriented by the discovery of his own ignorance. It threw him off balance, and now his life was in danger and he was trying to leave Seville, leave Spain, all in a headlong rush. They arrived at the waterfront. The beach was busy as always with stevedores and carts. At first glance, Barney reckoned there were about 40 ships moored. The morning tide was preferred for departure, for then the ship had a whole day of sailing ahead, but usually one or two would leave in the afternoon. However, the tide was already on the turn. They would soon be away. The three men hurried to the water's edge and scanned the vessels, looking for signs of imminent departure. Hatches closed. Captain on deck, crew in the rigging. A ship called Ciervo was already moving out of its berth, the crew using long poles to keep it away from the barks on either side. There was still time to get aboard, just. Carlos cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted,
"Skipper, do you want three strong deckhands?"
"No,"
came the answer. "I've got a complete crew."
"How about three passengers? We can't pay. No room."
He was probably planning something illegal, Barney speculated, and did not want it to be witnessed by people he did not know or trust. The commonest crime in these waters was offshore dealing in American silver to evade the king's taxes in Seville, but straightforward piracy was not unusual. They hurried along the riverbank, but their luck was out. No one else seemed to be leaving. Barney felt desperate. Now, what would they do? They reached the downstream limit of the harbour. It was marked by a fortress called the Golden Tower. At this point, an iron chain could be stretched from one bank to the other, so that raiders coming upstream from the sea could not attack the ships at anchor. Outside the fortress, a recruiter was at work, standing on a barrel, calling on young men to join the army.
"There's a hot meal and a bottle of wine for every man who enlists now," he shouted to a crowd of onlookers. "Over there is a ship called Jose y Maria, and the two blessed saints watch over her and guard all who sail in her."
He pointed, and Barney saw that he had an iron hand, presumably the artificial replacement for a real one lost in battle. Barney looked in the direction indicated, and saw a big three-masted galleon bristling with cannons, its deck already crowded with young men. The recruiter went on.
"We're sailing this afternoon to a place where there are wicked heathens to be killed, and where the girls are as willing as they are pretty, as I can tell you, my lads, from personal experience, if you know what I mean."
There was a knowing laugh from the crowd.
"I don't want you if you're weak," he said scornfully. "I don't want you if you're timid. I don't want you if you're a girly boy. And you know what I mean by that. This is only for the strong, the brave, and the tough. This is for real men."
On the deck of the Jose y Maria, someone shouted,
"All aboard! Last chance, lads,"
the recruiter called.
"What is it to be? Stay at home with your mama, eating bread and milk and doing as you're told? Or come with me, Captain Iron Hand Gomez, for a man's life, travel and adventure, fame and fortune. All you have to do is walk up that gangway, and the world is yours."
Barney, Carlos, and Ibrima looked at one another. Carlos said,
"Yes or no?"
Barney said,
"Yes."
Ibrima said,
"Yes."
The three men walked to the ship, climbed the gangway, and went on board. 2 days later, they were on the open sea. Ibrima had sailed many miles, but always as a captive, chained in the hold. Seeing the sea from the deck was a new and exhilarating experience. The recruits had nothing to do but speculate on their destination, which still had not been revealed. It was a military secret. Ibrima had an additional unanswered question, his future. When they had boarded the Jose y Maria, they had been met by an officer seated at a table with a ledger.
"Name,"
he had said, "Barney Willard." The officer wrote in the book, then looked at Carlos.
"Name?"
"Carlos Cruz." He wrote down the name, glanced at Ibrima, then put down his pen. Looking from Carlos to Barney and back, he had said,
"You can't have a slave in the army. An officer, again, though he has to feed and clothe a man out of his own money. But an enlisted soldier obviously can't do that."
Ibrima had studied Carlos's face closely. A look of desperation had come into Carlos's eyes. He saw his escape route closing. After only a moment's hesitation, he said the only thing he could say.
"He's not a slave. He's a free man."
Ibrima's heart had stopped. The officer had nodded. Freed slaves were rare, but by no means unknown.
"Fine,"
he had said. He had looked at Ibrima and said,
"Name?"
It had all been very quick, and when it was over, Ibrima still was not sure where he stood. Barney had not congratulated him on being freed, and Carlos had not acted like a man who has given a great gift. Clearly, Ibrima was to be treated as a free man in the army. But how real was it? Was he free or not? He did not know. Chapter 5. Marjorie's wedding was postponed. After the fall of Calais, England expected to be invaded, and Bart Shiring was deputed to raise 100 men-at-arms and garrison Coombe Harbour. The wedding would have to wait. For Ned Willard, postponement was hope. Towns such as Kingsbridge were hastily repairing their walls, and earls reinforcing their castles. Ports scraped the rust off the ancient cannons on their seafronts, and demanded that the local nobility do their duty and defend the population against the dreaded French. People blamed Queen Mary Tudor. It was all her fault, for marrying the King of Spain.
Were it not for him, Calais would still be English. England would not be at war with France, and there would be no need for city walls and waterfront cannons. Ned was glad. While Marjorie and Bart remained unmarried, anything could happen. Bart could change his mind, or be killed in battle, or die of the shivering fever that was sweeping the country. Marjorie was the woman Ned wanted, and that was that. The world was full of attractive girls, but none of them counted. She was the one. He did not really understand why he was so sure. He just knew that Marjorie would always be there, like the cathedral. He regarded her engagement as a setback, not a defeat. Bart and his squadron mustered in Kingsbridge to travel by barge to Coombe Harbour on the Saturday before Holy Week. That morning, a crowd gathered at the river to cheer the men off. Ned joined them. He wanted to be sure Bart really went. It was cold but sunny, and the waterfront looked festive. Downstream of Merthyn's Bridge, boats and barges were moored on both banks and all around Leper Island. On the far side, in the suburb of Loversfield, warehouses and workshops jostled for space. From Kingsbridge, the river was navigable, by shallow-draft vessels, all the way to the coast. Kingsbridge had long been one of the biggest market towns in England. Now it did business with Europe, too. A big barge was docking on the near bank when Ned arrived at Slaughterhouse Wharf. This had to be the vessel that would take Bart and his company to Coombe Harbour. 20 men had rowed upriver, assisted by a single sail. Now they rested on their oars while the barge was pulled into a berth. The downriver voyage would be easier, even with 100 passengers. The Fitzgeralds came down the main street to give an enthusiastic send-off to the man who was set to become their son-in-law. Sir Reginald and Rollo walked side by side, old and new editions of the same tall, thin, self-righteous book. Ned stared at them with hatred and contempt. Marjorie and Lady Jane were behind them, one small and sexy, one small and mean. Ned believed that Rollo saw Marjorie as nothing more than a means to power and prestige. Many men had this attitude to the girls in their family, but in Ned's eyes, it was the opposite of love. If Rollo was fond of his sister, it was no more than the emotion he might have felt toward a horse. He might like it, but he would sell or trade it if necessary. Sir Reginald was no better. Ned suspected that Lady Jane was not quite so ruthless, but she would always put the interests of the family before the happiness of any individual member, and in the end, that led her to the same cruelty. Ned watched Marjorie go up to Bart. He was preening, proud to have the prettiest girl in Kingsbridge as his fiancée. Ned studied her. It almost seemed as if there was a different person wearing the bright coat of Kingsbridge scarlet and the little hat with the feather. She stood straight and still, and although she was talking to Bart, her face was like that of a statue. Everything about her expressed resolution, not animation. The imp of mischief had vanished. But no one could change so quickly. That imp must still have been inside her somewhere. He knew she was miserable, and that made him angry as well as sad. He wanted to pick her up and run away with her. At night he elaborated fantasies in which the two of them slipped out of Kingsbridge at dawn and disappeared into the forest. Sometimes they walked to Winchester and got married under false names, or they made their way to London and set up in some business. They even went to Coombe Harbour and took ship to Seville. But he could not save her, unless she wanted to be saved. The oarsmen disembarked and went into the nearest tavern, the slaughterhouse, to quench their thirsts. A passenger got off the barge, and Ned stared at him in surprise. Wrapped in a grubby cloak and carrying a battered leather satchel, the man had the wearily dogged look of the long-distance traveller. It was Ned's cousin, Albert, from Calais. They were the same age, and had become close while Ned was living with Uncle Dick. Ned hurried to the quay. "Albert?" he said. "Is it you?" Albert replied in French. "Ned, at last," he said. "What a relief. What happened in Calais? We still haven't had definite information, even after all this time." "It's all bad news," Albin said. "My parents and my sister are dead, and we've lost everything. The French crown seized the warehouse and handed over everything to French merchants. We were afraid of that." It was the news the Willards had been dreading for so long, and Ned felt deeply dispirited. He was particularly sad for his mother, who had lost her life's work. She would be devastated. But Alban had suffered a much greater loss.
I'm so sorry about your parents and Therese.
Thank you.
Come to the house. You have to tell my mother everything.
Ned dreaded the moment, but it had to be done. They walked up the main street.
I managed to escape from the town,
Alban said, but I had no money, and anyway it's impossible to get passage from France to England now because of the war. That's why you've had no news.
So how did you get here?
First I had to leave France, so I crossed the border into the Netherlands, but I still didn't have the fare to England, so I had to get to our uncle in Antwerp.
Ned nodded.
Jan Volman, our father's cousin.
Jan had visited Calais while Ned was there, so Albin had met him.
So I walked to Antwerp. That's more than 100 miles, and my feet felt every yard. I took a lot of wrong turnings, and I nearly starved to death. But I got there.
Well done.
Uncle Jan took you in, no doubt.
He was wonderful. He fed me beef and wine, and Aunt Henny bandaged my feet. Then Jan bought me passage from Antwerp to Coombe Harbour and a new pair of shoes, and gave me money for the journey.
And here you are.
They arrived at the door of the Willard house. Ned escorted Alban into the parlour. Alice was sitting at a table placed near the window for light, writing in a ledger. There was a big fire in the grate, and she was wrapped in a fur-lined cloak. No one ever got warm keeping books, she sometimes said.
Mother,
here's Alban, arrived from Calais. Alice put down her pen.
Welcome, Alban.
She turned back to Ned.
Fetch your cousin something to eat and drink.
Ned went to the kitchen and asked the housekeeper, Janet Fife, to serve wine and cake. Back in the parlour, Alban told his story. He spoke French, with Ned translating the parts his mother did not understand. It brought tears to Ned's eyes. The portly figure of his mother seemed to shrink in the chair as the grim details came out. Her brother-in-law dead, with wife and daughter, the warehouse given to a French merchant, with all its contents, strangers living in Dick's house.
Poor Dick,
Alice said quietly.
Poor Dick.
Ned said,
I'm so sorry, Mother.
Alice made an effort to sit upright and be positive.
We're not ruined. Not quite. I still have this house and £400, and I own 6 houses by St. Mark's Church.
The St. Mark's cottages were her inheritance from her father and brought a small income in rents.
That's more wealth than most people see in a lifetime.
Then she was struck by a worrying thought. Though now I wish my £400 were not on loan to Sir Reginald Fitzgerald.
All the better, said Ned.
If he doesn't pay it back, we get the Priory.
Speaking of that,
said his mother,
Alba, do you know anything of an English ship called the St. Margaret?
Why, yes, said Alba. It came into Calais for repairs the day before the French attack.
What happened to the ship?
It was seized by the French crown, like all the other English property in Calais. Spoils of war. The hold was full of furs. They were auctioned on the quayside. They sold for more than £500. Ned and Alice looked at each other. This was a bombshell. Alice said,
So Reginald has lost his investment.
My goodness, I'm not sure he can survive this. Ned said, and he'll forfeit the Priory. Alice said grimly,
There will be trouble.
I know, said Ned. He'll squeal, but we will have a new business. He began to brighten. We can make a fresh start. Alice, always courteous, said,
Albert, you may like a wash and a clean shirt. Janet Fife will give you everything you need, and then we'll have dinner.
Thank you, Aunt Alice.
It is I who thank you for making this long journey and bringing me the facts at last. Terrible though they are.
Ned studied his mother's face. She had been rocked by the news, even though it was not unexpected. He felt desperate to do something to renew her spirits.
We could go and look at the Priory now, he said. We can begin to figure out how we'll parcel out space and whatnot.
She looked apathetic. Then she made an effort.
Why not? She said. It's ours now.
She got to her feet. They left the house and crossed the market square to the south side of the cathedral. Ned's father, Edmund, had been mayor of Kingsbridge when King Henry VIII began to abolish the monasteries. Alice had told Ned that Edmund and Prior Paul
who was the last prior of Kingsbridge, as things turned out, had seen what was coming, and conspired together to save the school. They had separated the school from the priory and given it self-government and an endowment. 200 years earlier, something similar had been done with Carus's hospital, and Edmund had taken that as a model. So the town still had a great school and a famous hospital. The rest of the priory was a ruin. The main door was locked, but the walls were falling down, and they found a place at the back of the old kitchen where they could clamber over rubble into the premises. Other people had had the same idea. Ned saw the ashes of a recent fire, a few scattered meat bones, and a rotted-out wineskin. Someone had spent a night here, probably with an illicit lover. There was a smell of decay inside the buildings, and the droppings of birds and rodents were everywhere. "And the monks were always so clean," Alice said dismally, looking around. "Nothing is permanent except change." Despite the dilapidation, Ned felt a keen sense of anticipation. All this now belonged to his family. Something wonderful could be made of it. How clever his mother was to think of it, and just when the family needed a rescue plan. They made their way to the cloisters and stood in the middle of the overgrown herb garden, by the ruined fountain where the monks used to wash their hands. Looking all around the arcade, Ned saw that many of the columns and vaults, parapets and arches were still sound, despite decades of neglect. The Kingsbridge masons had built well. "We should start here," said Alice. "We'll knock an archway through the west wall so that people can see in from the market square. We can divide the cloisters up into small shops, one to each bay." "That would give us 24, Ned said, counting. 23 if we use one for the entrance. The public can come into the quadrangle and look around." Ned could picture it, just as his mother obviously could. The stalls with bright textiles, fresh fruits and vegetables, boots and belts, cheese and wine. The stallholders calling their wares, charming their customers, taking money and making change. And the shoppers in their best clothes, clutching their purses, looking and touching and sniffing while they gossiped with their neighbours. Ned liked markets. They were where prosperity came from. "We don't need to do a lot of work, initially," Alice went on. "We'll have to clean the place up, but the stallholders can bring their own tables and anything else they need. Once the market is up and running and making money, we can think about repairing the stonework, renewing the roof, and paving the quadrangle." Suddenly, Ned felt they were being watched. He turned around. The south door of the cathedral was open, and Bishop Julius stood in the cloister, hands like claws on his bony hips, blue eyes glaring at them balefully. Ned felt guilty, though he had no reason to. Priests had that effect, he had noticed. Alice saw the bishop a moment later. She grunted with surprise. Then she muttered, "I suppose we might as well get this over with." Julius shouted indignantly, "What do you two think you're doing here?" "Good day, my lord bishop." Alice walked toward him, and Ned followed. "I'm examining my property." "What on earth do you mean? I own the priory now."
"No, you don't. Sir Reginald does."
The bishop's cadaverous face registered scorn, but Ned could see that beneath the bluster he was worried.
"Reginald pledged the priory to me as security for a loan he can't repay. He bought the cargo of a ship called the St. Margaret that has been confiscated by the French king, and he'll never get his money back. So now the property becomes mine. Naturally, I want us to be good neighbours, Bishop, and I look forward to discussing my plans."
"Wait a minute. You can't enforce that pledge."
"On the contrary, Kingsbridge is a trading city with a reputation for respecting contracts. Our prosperity depends on that. So does yours. Reginald promised to sell the priory back to the church, to which it rightfully belongs. Then Sir Reginald broke his promise to you when he pledged it as security for his loan. All the same, I'd be happy to sell the property to you, if that's what you would like."
Ned held his breath. He knew his mother did not really want to do this. Alice went on.
"Pay me the amount Reginald owes me, and the place is yours. £424.
424?
Bishop Julius repeated, as if there was something odd about the number.
"Yes."
The priory was worth more than that, Ned thought. If Julius had any sense, he would snap up this offer. But perhaps he did not have the money. The bishop said indignantly,
Reginald offered it to me at the price he paid for it. £80. That would have been a pious gift, not a business transaction. You should do the same. Reginald's habit of selling things for less than they're worth may be the reason he's now penniless.
The bishop shifted his ground.
What would you propose to do with these ruins?
I'm not sure,
Alice lied.
Let me develop some ideas, then come and talk to you.
Ned guessed she did not want to give Julius the chance to start a campaign against the market even before the plans were finished.
Whatever you try to do, I'll stop you.
That was not going to happen, Ned thought. Every alderman on the council knew how badly the town needed more space for citizens to sell their goods. Several of them were desperate for premises themselves, and would be the first to rent space in the new market.
I hope we can work together,
Alice said pacifically.
Julius said intemperately, You could be excommunicated for this.
Alice remained calm. The church has tried everything to get the monastic properties back, but Parliament won't permit it.
Sacrilege! The monks became rich, lazy, and corrupt, and the people lost respect for them. That's why King Henry was able to get away with dissolving the monasteries. Henry VIII was a wicked man. I want to be your friend and ally, my Lord Bishop, but not at the price of impoverishing myself and my family. The priory is mine.
No, it's not, said Julius.
It belongs to God.
Rollo bought drinks for all Bart Shiring's men-at-arms before they embarked for Coombe Harbour. He could not afford it, but he was keen to stay on good terms with his sister's fiancé. He did not want the engagement to be broken off. The marriage was going to transform the fortunes of the Fitzgerald family. Marjorie would be a countess, and if she gave birth to a son, he would grow up to become an earl. The Fitzgeralds would almost be aristocracy. However, they had not yet made that coveted leap. An engagement was not a marriage. The willful Marjorie could renew her mutiny, encouraged by the detestable Ned Willard, or her ill-concealed reluctance could offend Bart and cause him to break it off in a fit of wounded pride. So Rollo spent money he could not spare to foster his friendship with Bart. It was not easy. The camaraderie of brothers-in-law had to be mixed with deference and laced with flattery. But Rollo could do that. Raising his tankard, he said, My noble brother, may God's grace protect your strong right arm and help you repel the stinking French. That went down well. The men-at-arms cheered and drank. A handbell was rung, and they emptied their cups and went on board the barge. The Fitzgeralds waved from the quayside. When the barge was out of sight, Marjorie and the parents went home, but Rollo went back into the slaughterhouse. In the tavern, he had noticed one man who was not celebrating, but sitting in a corner on his own, looking depressed. He recognized the dark, lustrous hair and full lips of Donal Gloucester. He was interested. Donal was weak, and weak men could be useful. He bought two fresh tankards and went to sit with Donal. They were too far apart socially to be close friends, but they were the same age and had attended Kingsbridge Grammar School together. Rollo lifted his beer and said, Death to the French.
They won't invade us, said Donal,
but he drank anyway. What makes you so sure?
The King of France can't afford it. They might talk about an invasion, and they could do hit-and-run raids, but a real cross-channel armada would cost more than they have to spend.
Rollo thought Donal might know what he was talking about. His employer, Filbert Cobley, was more familiar with the costs of ships than anyone else in Kingsbridge, and as an international trader, he probably also understood the finances of the French crown.
So we should celebrate, he said.
Donal grunted. Rollo said,
You look like a man who has had bad news, old schoolmate.
Do I?
None of my business, of course.
You might as well know. Everyone will, soon. I proposed to Ruth Cobley and she turned me down.
Rollo was surprised. Everyone expected Donal to marry Ruth. It was the commonest thing in the world for an employee to marry the boss's daughter.
Doesn't her father like you?
I'd make a good son-in-law for him, because I know the business so well. But I'm not religious enough for Filbert.
Ah.
Rollo recalled the play at Newcastle. Donal had clearly been enjoying it,
and had seemed reluctant to join the Cobleys in their outraged walkout.
But you said Ruth turned you down.
Rollo would have thought Donald was attractive to girls, with his dark, romantic good looks.
She says I'm like a brother to her.
Rollo shrugged. There was no logic to love. Donald looked at him shrewdly.
You're not very interested in girls. Nor boys either, if that's what you were thinking.
It crossed my mind.
No.
The truth was that Rollo did not know what all the fuss was about. Masturbation for him was a mild pleasure, like eating honey, but the idea of sex with a woman, or another man, just seemed slightly distasteful. His preference was for celibacy. If the monastery still existed, he might have been a monk.
Lucky you,
Donald said bitterly. When I think of all the time I've spent trying to be the right husband for her, pretending not to like drinking and dancing and seeing plays, going to their boring services, talking to her mother. Rollo felt goosebumps at the back of his neck. Donald had said, going to their boring services. Rollo had long known that the Cobleys belonged to that dangerous class of people who thought they had the right to their own opinions about religion, but he had not previously come across evidence that they actually practiced their profanation here in Kingsbridge. He tried not to show his sudden excitement.
I suppose those services were pretty dull,
he said, endeavouring to sound casual. Donald immediately backtracked.
I should have said meetings,
he said. Of course they don't hold services. That would be heresy.
I know what you mean,
Rollo said. But there's no law against people praying together, or reading from the Bible, or singing hymns. Donald raised his tankard to his mouth, then put it down again.
I'm talking nonsense,
he said. His eyes showed the shadow of fear. I must have had too much to drink. He got to his feet with an effort. I'm going home.
Don't go,
said Rollo, eager to know more about Filbert Cobley's meetings.
Finish your tankard.
But Donald was scared.
Need to take a nap,
he mumbled. Thanks for the beer. He staggered away. Rollo sipped meditatively. The Cobleys and their friends were widely suspected of secretly having Protestant beliefs, but they were careful, and there was never the least evidence of illicit behaviour. As long as they kept their thoughts to themselves, they committed no offence. However, holding Protestant services was another matter. It was a sin and a crime, and the punishment was to be burned alive. And Donald, drunk and embittered, had momentarily lifted the veil. There was nothing much Rollo could do about it, for tomorrow Donald would surely deny everything and plead intoxication. But this information would prove useful one day. He decided to tell his father about it. He finished his drink and left. He arrived at the family home on the High Street at the same time as Bishop Julius.
We gave our soldiers a jolly good send-off,
he said cheerfully to the bishop.
Never mind about that, said Julius irascibly. I've got something to tell Sir Reginald.
Clearly he was angry, though fortunately his ire did not seem to be directed at the Fitzgeralds. Rollo led him into the great hall.
I'll fetch my father at once,
Rollo said. Please sit here in front of the fire. Julius gave a dismissive wave and began to pace up and down impatiently. Sir Reginald was taking a nap. Rollo woke him and told him the bishop was downstairs. Reginald groaned and got out of bed.
Give him a cup of wine while I dress,
he said. A few minutes later, the three men were seated in the hall. Julius began immediately.
Alice Willard has heard from Calais. The St. Margaret has been confiscated by the French and her cargo sold.
Despair seized Rollo.
I knew it,
he said. It had been his father's last throw of the dice, and he had lost. What would they do now? Sir Reginald flushed with anger.
What the devil was the ship doing in Calais?
Rollo answered him.
Jonas Bacon told us that when he met the ship, its captain was intending to go into port for minor repairs, hence the delay. But Bacon didn't say the port was Calais.
No. Reginald's freckled face twisted with hatred.
He knew, though, he said, and I'll bet Filbert did too when he sold us the cargo.
Of course Filbert knew, the lying, hypocritical Protestant swindler.
Rollo was boiling with rage. We've been robbed. The bishop said,
If that's so, can you get your money back from Filbert?
Never, said Reginald. A town like this can't let people renege on contracts, even when there has been sharp practice. The contract is sacred. Rollo, who had studied law, knew he was right. The court of quarter sessions will uphold the validity of the transaction, he said. Bishop Julius said, If you've lost that money, will you be able to repay Alice Willard?
No.
And you pledged the priory as security for the loan?
Yes.
Alice Willard told me this morning that the priory is hers now.
Damn her eyes, said Reginald.
So she's right.
Yes.
You are going to let the church have the priory back, Reginald.
Don't ask for sympathy from me, Julius. I've just lost £400.
424, Willard told me.
Correct.
Julius seemed to think the exact figure was significant, and Rollo wondered why, but he did not get a chance to ask. His father stood up restlessly and walked across the room and back again.
I'll get Filbert for this, I swear it. He'll find out that no one swindles Reginald Fitzgerald and gets away with it.
I'll see him suffer. I don't know how.
Rollo experienced a flash of inspiration, and he said,
I do.
What?
I know how to get revenge on Filbert.
Reginald stopped pacing and stared at Rollo with narrowed eyes.
What have you got in mind?
Filbert's clerk, Donald Gloucester, was drunk in the slaughterhouse this afternoon. He's been rejected by Filbert's daughter. Drink loosened his tongue, and resentment made him malicious. He told me that the Cobleys and their friends hold services. Bishop Julius was outraged.
Services? With no priest? That's heresy.
As soon as I took him up on it, Donald changed his story and said they were only meetings. Then he looked guilty and clammed up.
The bishop said, I've long suspected that the rats perform Protestant rites in secret. But where? And when? And who attends?
I don't know, said Rollo, but Donald does.
Will he tell?
Perhaps. Now that Ruth has rejected him, he no longer has any loyalty to the Cobley family.
Let's find out.
Let me go and see him. I'll take Osmond.
Osmond Carter was the head of the watch. He was a big man with a brutal streak.
What will you say to Donald?
I'll explain that he is suspected of heresy, and he's going to be put on trial unless he tells all.
Will that scare him?
He'll shit.
Bishop Julius said thoughtfully,
This could be a good moment to strike against the Protestants. The Catholic Church is sadly on the defensive. Queen Mary Tudor is unpopular because of the loss of Calais. Her rightful heir, Mary Stuart, the Queen of the Scots, is about to get married in Paris, and a French husband will turn the English against her. Sir William Cecil and his pals are going around the country trying to drum up support for the illegitimate Elizabeth Tudor as heir to the throne. So a clampdown on Kingsbridge heretics now would be a useful boost to Catholic morale.
So, Rollo thought, we will be doing God's will as well as getting our revenge. He felt ferocity boil up in his heart. His father clearly felt the same.
Do it, Rollo, Reginald said. Do it now.
Rollo put on his coat and left the house. The Guildhall was right across the street. Sheriff Mathewson had a room on the ground floor, with a clerk, Paul Pettit, who wrote letters and kept documents in careful order in a chest. Mathewson could not always be relied upon to do the bidding of the Fitzgerald family. He would occasionally defy Sir Reginald, saying that he served the Queen, not the mayor. Happily, the sheriff happened to be away from his room today, and Rollo had no intention of sending for him. Instead, he went down to the basement, where Osmond and the rest of the watchmen were preparing for their Saturday night duties. Osmond wore a close-fitting leather helmet that made him look even more pugnacious. He was lacing up knee boots.
I need you to come with me to question someone, Rollo said to Osmond. You won't need to say anything.
He was going to add, just look menacing, but that would have been superfluous. They walked down the main street together in late afternoon light.
Rollo wondered whether he had been right to assure his father and the bishop that Donald would crack. If Donald had sobered up by now, he might be tougher. He could apologize for talking trash while drunk, and deny point-blank that he had ever been to any kind of Protestant service. Then it would be hard to prove anything. Passing the wharves, Rollo was greeted by Susan White, a baker's daughter of his own age. She had a heart-shaped face and a sweet nature. When they were both younger, they had kissed and tried other mild experiments. That was when Rollo had realized that sex did not have the power over him that it had over boys such as Donald Gloucester and Ned Willard, and his dalliance with Susan had come to nothing. He might marry anyway, one day, in order to have someone to manage his household, but in that event he would hope for someone of higher rank than a baker's daughter. Susan bore him no resentment. She had had plenty of boyfriends. Now she looked sympathetic.
"I'm sorry you lost your cargo," she said. "It seems unfair."
"It is unfair." Rollo was not surprised that the story was getting around. Half of Kingsbridge was involved one way or another in trading by sea, and everyone was interested in good or bad shipping news.
"You're due for some good luck next," Susan said. "That's what people say, anyway."
"I hope it's true." Susan looked with curiosity at Osmond, evidently wondering what Rollo and he were up to. Rollo did not want to have to explain, so he brought the conversation to an end. "Forgive me, I'm in a hurry."
"Goodbye."
Rollo and Osmond walked on. Donald lived in the southwest of the city, the industrial quarter known as the Tanneries. The north and east had long been the desirable neighbourhoods. The Priory had always owned the land upstream of Merthyn's Bridge, and there the water was clean. The Borough Council directed industry downstream, and all of Kingsbridge's dirty enterprises, leather tanning, textile dyeing, coal washing, paper making, sluiced their filth into the river here, as they had done for centuries. Tomorrow was Sunday, and people would be exchanging news at church, Rollo reflected. By the evening, everyone in Kingsbridge would know what had happened to the St. Margaret. They might sympathize, like Susan, or they might think Sir Reginald was a fool to let himself be cheated, but either way, they would regard the Fitzgeralds with a mixture of pity and scorn. Rollo could hear them being wise after the event, saying, "That Felbert's a sly one. He never sold anyone a bargain. Sir Reginald should have known that." The thought made Rollo cringe. He hated the idea of people looking down on his family. But they would change their tune when Filbert was arrested for heresy. It would be seen as Filbert's punishment. People would say, "It doesn't pay to swindle Sir Reginald. Filbert should have known that." The honour of the family would be restored, and once again Rollo's chest would swell with pride when he told people his name. If he could get Donald to talk. Rollo led the way to a small house beyond the docks. The woman who opened the door had Donald's sensual good looks. She recognized Osmond and said,
"Mercy, what's my boy done?"
Rollo pushed past her into the house, and Osmond followed.
"I'm sorry he got drunk," she said. "He suffered a terrible disappointment."
Rollo said, "Is your husband at home?"
"He's dead."
Rollo had forgotten that. It made things easier. "Where's Donald?"
"I'll fetch him."
She turned away. Rollo caught her arm. "When I speak to you, you must listen to what I say. I didn't tell you to get him. I asked you where he is." Her brown eyes flashed anger, and for a moment Rollo thought she was going to tell him she would do as she pleased in her own house. Then she got herself under control, no doubt fearing that defiance would make things worse for her son. Eyes downcast, she said,
"In bed. First door at the top of the stairs."
"You wait here. Osmond, come with me." Donald was prone on the bed, fully dressed except for his boots. There was a smell of puke, though it seemed his mother might have cleaned up the worst of it. Rollo shook him awake. He came round blearily. When he saw Osmond, he sat bolt upright and said,
"Jesus Christ, save me!"
Rollo sat on the edge of the bed and said, "Christ will save you, if you tell the truth. You're in trouble, Donald." Donald was bewildered.
"What kind of trouble?"
"Don't you recall our talk in the slaughterhouse?" Donald looked panicky as he tried to remember.
Vaguely?
"You told me you attended Protestant services with the Cobley family,
I never said anything of the kind.
I've already spoken to Bishop Julius. You're going to stand trial for heresy.
No.
Trials rarely found men not guilty. The general view was that if a man were innocent, he would not have got into trouble in the first place. You'll be better off if you tell the truth.
I am telling the truth.
Osmond said,
Shall I beat it out of him?
Donald looked terrified. Then his mother's voice was heard from the doorway.
You're not going to beat anyone, Osmond. My son is a law-abiding citizen and a good Catholic boy, and if you touch him, you're the one who'll be in trouble.
It was a bluff. Osmond never got into trouble for beating people, but it gave heart to Donald. Looking braver, he said,
I have never attended a Protestant service with Filbert Cobley or anyone else.
Mrs. Gloucester said,
You can't hold a man to account for what he says when drunk. And if you try to, you'll make a fool of yourself, young Rollo.
Rollo cursed.